Welcome to this Uvula Audio presentation of L. Frank Baum's Policeman Blue Jay, Volume 2, Chapter 4, An Afternoon Reception. Twinkle and Chubbins stretched their little necks to see what was coming, and a moment later beheld one of the most gorgeous sights the forest affords, a procession of all the bright-hued birds that live among the trees or seek them for shelter. They flew in pairs, one after the other, and at the head of the procession was their good friend, Policeman Blue Jay, wearing a policeman's helmet upon his head and having a policeman's club tucked underneath his left wing. The helmet was black and glossy and had a big number 1 on the front of it, and a strap that passed under the wearer's bill and held it firmly in place. The club was fastened around the policeman's wing with a cord so that it could not get away when he was flying. The birds were of many sizes and of various colorings. Some were much larger than the blue jay, but none seemed so proud or masterful, and all deferred meekly to the commands of the acknowledged guardian of the forest. One by one the pretty creatures alighted upon the limbs of the tree, and the first thing they all did was to arrange their feathers properly after their rapid flight. Then the blue jay, who sat next to the child larks, proceeded to introduce the guests he had brought to call upon the newest inhabitants of his domain.
"This is Mr. and Mrs. Robin Redbreast, one of our most aristocratic families," he said, swinging his club around in a circle, until Chubbins ducked his head for fear it might hit him.
"You are welcome to our forest,"
chirped Robin in a sedate and dignified tone.
"And here is Mr. Goldfinch and his charming bride," continued the policeman.
"Ah, it's a pleasure to meet you."
The goldfish murmured, eyeing the child larks curiously, but trying to be polite so that they would not notice his staring.
"Henny Wren and Jenny Wren," proceeded the policeman.
Twinkle and Chubbins both bowed politely.
"Well, well," croaked a raven in a hoarse voice. "Am I to wait all day while you introduce those miserable little insignificant grub-eaters?"
"Be quiet," cried Policeman Blue Jay sternly.
"I won't,"
snapped the raven. It happened so quickly that the children saw nothing before they heard the thump of the club against the raven's head.
"Murder! Help!"
screamed the big bird, and flew away from the tree as swiftly as his ragged wings would carry him.
"Let him go,"
said a sweet brown mocking bird.
"The rowdy is always disturbing our social gatherings, and no one will miss him if he doesn't come back."
"He is not fit for polite society,"
added a nuthatch, pruning her scarlet wings complacently. So the policeman tucked the club under his wing again and proceeded with the introductions, the peewees and the linnets being next presented to the strangers, and then the comical little chickadees, the orioles, bobolinks, thrushes, starlings, and whippoorwills, the latter appearing sleepy because they explained they had been out late the night before. These smaller birds all sat in rows on the limbs beside Twinkle and Chubbins, but seated upon the stouter limbs facing them were rows of bigger birds who made the child larks nervous by the sharp glances from their round, bright eyes.
Here were the blackbirds, cuckoos, magpies, grosbeaks, and wood pigeons, all nearly as big and fierce-looking as Policeman Blue Jay himself, and some so rugged and strong that it seemed strange they would submit to the orders of the officer of the law. But the policeman kept a sharp watch upon these birds to see that they attempted no mischievous pranks, and they must have been afraid of him because they behaved very well after the saucy raven had left them. Even the chattering magpies tried to restrain their busy tongues, and the blackbirds indulged in no worse pranks than to suddenly spread their wings and try to push the pigeons off the branch. Several beautiful hummingbirds were poised in the air above this gathering, their bodies being motionless, but their tiny wings fluttering so swiftly that neither Twinkle nor Chubbins could see them at all. Policeman Bluejay, having finally introduced all the company to the child larks, began to relate the story of their adventures, telling the birds how the wicked tussocks had transformed them into the remarkable shapes they now possessed. "For the honor of our race, we must each and every one of us guard these little strangers carefully and see that they come to no harm in our forest. You must all pledge yourselves to befriend them on all occasions, and if any dares to break his promise, he must fight with me to the death, and you know very well what that means."
"We do,"
said a magpie with a shrill laugh.
"You'll treat us as you did Jim Crow, huh?"
The policeman did not notice this remark, but the other birds all looked grave and thoughtful, and began in turn to promise that they would take care to befriend the child larks at all times. This ceremony having been completed, the birds began to converse in a more friendly and easy tone, so that Twinkle and Chubbins soon ceased to be afraid of them, and enjoyed very much their society and friendly chatter. Chapter 5. The Oriole's Story. An oriole sat next to Twinkle and said,
"We are really very happy in this forest, and we would have no fear at all did not the men with guns, who are called hunters, come here now and then to murder us. They are terribly wild and ferocious creatures, who have no hearts at all."
"Oh, they must have hearts," said Twinkle, "else they couldn't live. For one's heart has to beat to keep a person alive, you know."
"Perhaps it's their gizzards that beat," replied the oriole reflectively. "For they are certainly heartless and very wicked. A cousin of mine, Susie Oriole, had a very brave and handsome husband. They built a pretty nest together, and Susie laid 4 eggs in it that were so perfect she was very proud of them. The eggs were nearly ready to hatch when a great man appeared in the forest and discovered Susie's nest. Her brave husband fought desperately to protect their home, but the cruel man shot him, and he fell to the ground dead. Even then, Susie would not leave her pretty eggs, and when the man climbed the tree to get them, she screamed and tried to peck out his eyes. Usually we orioles are very timid, so you can well understand how terrified Susie was to fight against this giant foe. But he had a club in his hand, and he dealt my poor cousin such a dreadful blow, she was sent whirling through the air and sank half unconscious into a bush a few yards away. The man stole the eggs from the nest. Stole the eggs from the nest! After that, he picked up the dead body of Susie's husband and carried it away with him. When Susie recovered somewhat from the blow she'd received, and saw her eggs and her poor dead husband being taken away, she managed to flutter along after the man and followed him until he came to the edge of the forest. And he had a horse tied to a tree. He mounted upon the beast's back and rode away through the open country. Susie followed just far enough away to keep the man in sight without being noticed herself. By and by he came to a big house. He entered and closed the door behind him. Susie flew into a tree beside the house and waited sorrowfully but in patience for a chance to find her precious ones again. The days passed drearily away, one after another, but in about a week my cousin noticed that one of the windows of the house had been left open, so she boldly left her tree and flew in at the window, and luckily none of the people who lived in the house happened to be in the room. Imagine Susie's surprise when she saw around the size of the room many birds sitting silently upon limbs cut from trees,
and among them her own husband, as proud and beautiful as he had ever been before the cruel man had killed him. She quickly flew to the limb and perched beside her loved one. "Oh, my darling," she cried, "how glad I am to have found you again and see you alive and well when I had mourned you as dead. Come with me at once, and we will return to our old home in the forest." But the bird remained motionless and made no reply to her loving words. She thrust her bill beside his and tried to kiss him, but he didn't respond to the caress, and his body was stiff and cold. Then Susie uttered a cry of grief and understood the truth. Her husband was indeed dead, but had been stuffed and mounted upon the limb to appear as he had been in life. Small wires had been pushed through his legs to make his poor body stand up straight, and to Susie's horror she discovered his eyes were only bits of glass, and all the other birds in the room were stuffed in the same way. They looked as if they were alive at first glance, but each body was cold and every voice mute. They were mere mockeries of the beautiful birds that this heartless and cruel man had deprived of their joyous lives. Susie's loving heart was nearly bursting with pain as she slowly fluttered toward the open window that she'd entered by. But on her way, a new anguish overtook her, for she noticed a big glass case against the wall in which were arranged clusters of eggs, stolen from birds of almost every kind. And yes, there were her own lovely eggs, scarcely an inch from her face, but separated from her by a stout glass that could not be broken, although she madly dashed her body against it again and again. Finally, realizing her helplessness, poor Susie left the room by the open window and flew back to the forest, where she told us all the terrible things she had seen. No one was able to comfort her, for her loving heart had been broken, and after that she would often fly away to the house to peer through the window at her eggs and her beautiful husband. One day she didn't come back, and after waiting for her nearly 2 weeks, we sent Policeman Blue Jay to see what had become of her. A policeman found the house and also found the window of the room open. He boldly entered and discovered Susie and her husband sitting side by side upon the dried limb, their bodies both stiff and dead. The man had caught the poor wife at last, and the lovers were reunited in death. Also, Policeman Blue Jay found his grandfather's mummy in that room, and the stuffed mummies of many other friends he had known in the forest. So he was very sorrowful when he returned to us. And from that time we have feared the heartless men more than ever.
It's a sad story, and I've got no doubt it's a true one, but all men are not so bad, I'm sure,
sighed Twinkle.
All men who enter the forest are, answered the Oriole positively, for they only come here to murder and destroy those who are helpless before their power, but have never harmed them in the least. If God loves the birds, as I am sure he does, why do you suppose he made their ferocious enemies men?
Twinkle didn't have a reply, but she felt a little ashamed. Chapter 6. A Merry Adventure.
Talking about men, said the cuckoo in a harsh but not very unpleasant voice, reminds me of a funny adventure I once had myself. I was sitting in my nest one day, at the time when I was very young, when suddenly a man appeared before me. You must know that this nest, which was rather carelessly built by my mother, was in a thick evergreen tree, and not very high from the ground, so that I found the man's eyes staring squarely into my own. Most of you, my dears, have seen men, but this was the strangest sort of man you can imagine. There was white hair upon his face, so long it hung down to his middle, and over his eyes were round plates of glass that glittered very curiously. I was so astonished at seeing the queer creature that I sat still and stared. And this was my undoing, for suddenly there came a rapid whoosh through the air, and a network of cords fell all around and over me. Then, indeed, I spread my wings and attempted to fly, but I was too late. I struggled in the net without avail, and soon gave up the conflict in breathless despair. My captor did not intend to kill me, however.
Instead, he tried to soothe my fright and carried me very gently for many, many miles, until we came to a village of houses. Here, at the very top of a high house, the man lived in one little room. It was all littered with tools and bits of wood, and on a board were several queer things that went tick-tock, tick-tock every minute. I was thrust very gently into a wooden cage, where I lay upon the bottom more dead than alive, because the ticking things at first scared me dreadfully, and I was in constant terror lest I should be tortured or killed. But the glassy-eyed old man brought me dainty things to eat, and plenty of fresh water to relieve my thirst, and by the next day my heart had stopped going pitty-pat, and I was calm enough to stand up in my cage and look around. My white-whiskered captor sat at a bench, with his coat off and his bald head bare, while he worked away, busily putting little wheels and springs together, and fitting them into a case of wood. When one of them was finished, it would sing tick-tock, tick-tock, just like the other queer things on the shelf. But this constant ticking so interested me, I raised my head and called, "Tinkers! Tinkers!" "That's it," cried the old man delightedly. "That's what I wanted to hear. It's the real cuckoo at last, and not a bit like those cheap imitations." I didn't understand what he meant, but he worked at his bench all day and finally brought to my cage a bird made of wood that was carved and painted to look just like me. It seemed so natural that I flapped my wings and called cuckoo to it, and the man pressed a little bellows at the bottom of the bird and made it say cuckoo in return. But the cry was so false and unreal that I just shouted with laughter, and the glass-eyed old man shook his head sadly and said, "That will never do. That will never do in the world." So the next day he worked hard trying to make his wooden bird say cuckoo in the proper way, and at last it really spoke quite naturally, so that it startled even me when I heard it. This seemed to please my captor very much. So he put it inside of the ticking things on the shelf, and by the door opened, and the wooden bird jumped out and cried, "Cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo," and then jumped back inside again, and the door closed with a snap. "Bravo," cried the old white hare. But I was rather annoyed, for I thought the wooden bird was impudent in trying to ape the ways of live cuckoos. I shouted back a challenge to it. But there was no reply. An hour later, and every hour, it repeated the performance, but jumped behind the door when I offered to fight it. Tinkers! Tinkers! The next day, the man was absent from the room, and I had nothing to eat, so I became angry and uneasy. I scratched away at the wooden bars of my cage and tried to twist them with my beak, and at last one of them, to my great joy, came loose, and I was able to squeeze myself out of the cage. But by then I was no better off than before, because the windows and door of the room were fast shut. I grew more cross and ill-tempered than before when I discovered this, and to add to my annoyance, that miserable wooden bird would every once in a while jump out and yell cuckoo at me, and then bounce back into its house again without daring to argue. This made me frantic with rage. I resolved to be revenged. The next time the wooden bird made its appearance, I flew upon it in a flash and knocked it off its little platform before it had uttered its cry more than twice. It fell upon the floor and broke one of its wings, but in an instant I dashed myself upon it and bit and scratched the impudent thing until there was not a bit of paint left upon it. Its head came off too, and so did its legs and the other wing, and before I was done with it, no one would have ever known it was once a clever imitation of me. Finding that I was victorious, I cried "Tinkers!" in triumph, and just then the little door of the ticking thing opened, and the platform where the wooden bird had stood came out and remained for a time motionless. I quickly flew up and perched upon it, and shouted "Tinkers!" again in great glee. And as I did so, to my amazement, the platform on which I stood leapt backwards, carrying me with it, and the next instant the door closed with a snap, and I found myself in darkness. I wildly fluttered my wings, but it was no use. I was in a prison much worse than the cage, and so small I could hardly turn around in it.
I was about to die of terror and despair when I chanced to remember that at certain times the door would open to push out the bird and allow it to say cuckoo before it shut again. So the next time it opened in this way, I would be able to make my escape. Very patiently, I waited in the tiny dark little hall, listening to the steady tick-tock of the machinery behind me, and trying not to be nervous. After a while, I heard the old man come into the room and exclaim sorrowfully because his captive cuckoo had escaped from its cage. He could not imagine what had become of me, and I kept still and laughed to myself to think how I would presently surprise him. It seemed an age before I finally heard the click that opened the door in front of me. Then the platform on which I sat sprang out, and I fluttered my wings and yelled, as loudly as I could. The old man was standing right in front of me, his mouth wide open with astonishment at the wonderfully natural performance of his wooden bird, as he thought me. He shouted bravo again and clapped his hands, and at that moment I flew straight into his face and clawed his white hair with all my might and screamed as loudly as I could. He screamed too, being taken by surprise, and tumbled backwards so that he sat down upon the floor with a large bump. I flew to the workbench, and then the truth dawned upon him that I was not the wooden bird, but the real one. "Good gracious," he said, "I've left the window open. The rascal will escape." I glanced at the window and saw that it was indeed wide open. The sight filled me with triumphant joy, and before the old man could get upon his feet and reach the window, I had perched upon the sill, and with one parting cry of I spread my wings and flew straight into the air. Well, I never went back to inquire if he enjoyed the trick I had played upon him, but I've laughed many times when I've thought of the old fellow's comic expression when a real cuckoo instead of a painted one flew out of his ticking machine. As the cuckoo ended his tale, the other birds joined in a chorus of shrill laughter. But Chubbins said to them gravely, "He was a smart man, though, to make a cuckoo clock. I saw one myself once, and it was a wonderful thing. The cuckoo told what time it was every hour."
"Was it made of wood?" asked the blue jay.
"I don't know that," replied the boy lark. "But of course it wasn't a real bird."
"It only shows,"
remarked the bobolink, "how greatly those humans admire us birds. They make pictures of us and love to keep us in cages so they can hear us sing, and they even wear us in their bonnets after we're dead."
"I think that is a dreadful thing," said the goldfinch with a shudder. "It only proves that men are our greatest enemies."
"Don't forget the women," said Twinkle. "It's the women that wear the birds in their hats."
"Mankind," said Robin Redbreast gravely, "is the most destructive and bloodthirsty of all of brute creation. They not only kill for food, but through vanity and desire for personal adornment. I have even heard it said that they kill for amusement, being unable to restrain their murderous desires. In this they are more cruel than the serpents."
"There is some excuse for the poor things," observed Blue Jay, "for nature created them dependent upon animals and birds and fishes. Having neither fur nor feathers to protect their poor skinny bodies, they wear clothing made of fleece of sheep and skins of seals and beavers and otters and even the humble muskrats. They cover their feet and their hands with skins of beasts. They sleep upon the feathers of birds. Their food is the flesh of beasts and birds and fishes. No created thing is so dependent upon others as man. Therefore he's the greatest destroyer in the world, but he's not alone in his murderous, despoiling instinct. While you rail at humans, my friends, don't forget that birds themselves are the greatest enemies of birds."
"Nonsense!"
cried the magpie indignantly.
"Perhaps the less you say about this matter, the better," declared the blue jay, swinging his club in a suggestive manner and looking sharply at the magpie.
"It's a slander," said the blackbird. "I'm sure you can't accuse me of injuring birds in any way."
"If you're all innocent, why are we obliged to have a policeman?"
inquired the little wren in a nervous voice.
"Tell me,"
said Twinkle, appealing to the blue jay,
"are the big birds really naughty to the little ones?"
Why, it's the same with us as it is with men, replied the policeman. There are good ones and bad ones among us, and the bad ones have to be watched. Men destroy us wantonly. Other animals and sly serpents prey upon us and our eggs for food. But these are open enemies, and we know how we may best avoid them. Our most dangerous foes are those bandits of our own race, who instead of protecting their brethren, steal our eggs and murder our young. They're not always the biggest birds by any means that do those things. The crow family is known to be treacherous, and the shrike is rightly called the butcher bird, but there are many others we have reason to suspect feed upon their own race.
How dreadful!
Exclaimed the girl lark. The birds all seemed restless and uneasy at this conversation, and looked upon one another with suspicious glances. But the blue jay soothed them all by saying, After all, I suppose we imagine more evil than really exists, and sometimes accuse our neighbors wrongfully. But the mother birds know how often their nests have been robbed in their absence, and if they suspect some neighbor of the crime, instead of a prowling animal, it's natural, since many birds can't be trusted. There are laws in the forest, of course, but the guilty ones are often able to escape. I'll tell you of a little tragedy that happened only last week, which will prove how apt we are to be mistaken. Chapter 7. The Blue Jay's Story. There's no more faithful mother in the forest than the blue titmouse, which is a cousin to the chickadee. And this spring, Tom Titmouse and his wife Nancy set up housekeeping in a little hollow in an elm tree about half a mile north of this spot. Of course, the first thing Nancy did was to lay 6 beautiful eggs, white with brown spots all over them in the nest. Tom was proud of those eggs, as was Nancy, and as the nest was hidden in a safe place, they flew away together to hunt for caterpillars, and had no thought of danger. But on their return an hour later, to their sorrow, they found the nest empty, and every pretty egg gone. On the ground underneath the tree were scattered bits of shell, but the robber was nowhere to be seen. Tom Titmouse was very indignant at this dreadful crime, and came to me at once to complain of the matter. But of course I had no idea who'd done the deed. I questioned all the birds who have ever been known to slyly steal eggs, and every one of them denied the robbery. So Nancy Titmouse saw she had to lay more eggs, and before long she had another 6 speckled beauties in the bottom of her nest. They were more careful this time about leaving home, but the danger seemed past, and one bright sunny morning they ventured to fly to the brook to drink and bathe themselves, and on their return found their home despoiled for a second time. Not an egg was left to them out of the 6, and while Nancy wept and wailed, Tom looked sharply around him and saw a solitary shrike sitting on a limb not very far away.
"What's a shrike?" asked Chubbins.
"It's a bird that looks a good deal like that mockingbird sitting next to you, but it bears a bad character in the forest and has earned the name of Butcher Bird. I admit that I'm always obliged to keep an eye upon the shrike, for I expect it to get into mischief at any time." Well, Tom Titmouse naturally thought the shrike had eaten Nancy's eggs, so he came to me and ordered me to arrest the robber. But the shrike pleaded his innocence, and I had no proof against him. Again, Nancy, with true motherly courage and perseverance, laid eggs in the bottom of her nest, and now they were never left alone for a single minute. Either she or Tom was always at home, and for my part, I watched the shrike carefully and found he didn't fly near the nest of the titmice at all. The result of our care was that one fine day the eggs hatched, and out came 6 skinny little titmice with big heads and small bodies, and they nestled against Nancy's breast. The mother thought they were beautiful, you may be sure, and many birds gathered around to congratulate her and Tom, and the brown thrush sang a splendid song of welcome to the little ones. When the children got a little stronger, it didn't seem necessary to guard the nest so closely, and the 6 appetites required a good many insects,
and butterfly eggs to satisfy them, so Tom and Nancy both flew away to search for food. And when they came back, to their horror, they found that their six little ones had been stolen, and the nest was bare and cold. Nancy nearly fainted with sorrow, and her cries were pitiful and heart-rending. But Tom Titmouse was dreadfully angry and came to me demanding vengeance. "If you're any good at all as a policeman," he said, "you'll discover and punish the murderer of my babies." So I looked all around and finally discovered, not far from the nest of the titmice, four of their children, all dead, and each one impaled upon the thorn of a bush that grew close to the ground. Then I decided it had to indeed be the shrike, for he has a habit of doing just that kind of thing, killing more than he can eat and sticking the rest of his murdered victims on thorns until he finds time to come back and devour them. I was pretty angry by that time, so I flew to the shrike's nest and found him all scratched and torn, his feathers plucked in many places. "What happened to you?" I asked. "I had a fight with a weasel last night," he answered, "and both of us are rather used up today." "Still," I said sternly, "you had enough strength to kill the six little titmice and eat two of them." "I never did that," he said earnestly. "My wings are too stiff to fly." "Don't lie about it," I said, "for we have found four of the dead titmice stuck on the thorns of a bush, and your people are known to do that kind of thing." At that, the shrike looked worried. "Really," he said, "I cannot understand, but I assure you I'm innocent." Nonetheless, I arrested him and made him fly with me to the judgment tree, where all the birds had congregated. He was really stiff and sore, and I could see it hurt him to fly, but my duty was plain. We selected a jury of 12 birds, and Judge Bullfinch took his seat on a bough, and then the trial began. Tom Titmouse accused the shrike of murder, and so did Nancy, who had nearly cried her eyes out. I also gave my evidence. But the prisoner insisted he was innocent and claimed he had not left his nest since his fight with the weasel, and so was guiltless of the crime. But no one had any sympathy for him or believed what he said, for it's often the case that when one has earned a bad reputation, he's thought capable of any wickedness. So the jury declared him guilty, and the judge condemned him to die at sundown. We were all to fall upon the prisoner together and tear him to bits with bill and claw. But while we waited for the sun to sink, Will Sparrow flew up to the judgment tree and said, "Hello there, what's going on here?" And we told him we're just about to execute a criminal. "What has he been doing?" asked Will, eyeing the shrike curiously. "He killed the titmice children this morning and ate two of them and stuck the other four on a thorn bush," explained the judge. "Oh no, the shrike didn't do that," cried Will Sparrow. "I saw that crime committed with my own eyes. It was a weasel, a cunning one that lives in the pine stump, that did the dreadful murder." At this all the birds set up an excited chatter, and the shrike again screamed he was innocent. So the judge said gravely, "Will Sparrow always speaks the truth. Release the prisoner, for we have misjudged him. We must exact our vengeance upon the weasel." So we all flew swiftly to the pine stump, which we knew well, and when we arrived, we found the weasel sitting at the edge of his hole, laughing at us. "That's the very weasel I fought with," said the shrike. "You can see where I tore the fur from his head and back with my sharp beak." "So you did," answered the weasel, "and in return I killed the little tomtits." "Did you stick them on the thorns?" asked Judge Bullfinch. "Yes, I did," said the weasel, "and I hoped you would accuse the shrike of the murder and kill him to satisfy my vengeance." "Well, we nearly fell into your trap," returned the judge, "but Will Sparrow saw your act and reported it just in time to save the shrike's life. But tell me, did you also eat Nancy Titmouse's eggs?" "Of course," confessed the weasel, "and they were very good. They tasted great."
Hearing this, Tom Titmouse became so excited he made a furious dash at the weasel, who slipped into his hole and escaped. Well, the judge cried, "I condemn you to death." "That's all right," answered the weasel, sticking just the tip of his nose out of the hole. "But you've got to catch me before you can kill me. Run home, my pretty little birds. You're no match for a weasel." And then he was gone from sight, and we knew he was hidden safely in the stump, where we couldn't follow him, for the weasel's body is slim and slender. But I haven't lived in the forest all my life without learning a few things, and I whispered a plan to Judge Bullfinch that met with his approval. He sent messengers at once for the ivory-billed woodpeckers, and soon four of those big birds appeared and agreed to help us, and they began tearing away at the stump with their strong beaks. And the splinters flew in every direction. It was not yet dark when the cunning weasel was dragged from his hole, and was at the mercy of the birds he had so cruelly offended. We fell upon him in a flash, and he was dead almost instantly.
"What became of the shrike?"
asked Twinkle. "He left the forest the next day, for although he was innocent of this crime, he was still a butcher bird, and he knew our people had no confidence in him."
"It was lucky Will Sparrow came in time," said the girl Lark. "But all these stories must have made you hungry, so I'd like to invite my guests to have some refreshments."
The birds seemed much surprised at this invitation, and even Policeman Blue Jay wondered what she was going to do. But Twinkle whispered to Chubbins, and both the bird children flew into their basket and returned with their claws full of cookie. They repeated this journey many times, distributing bits of the rare food to all of the birds who had visited them, and each one ate the morsel eagerly and declared that it was very good.
"Now," said the policeman when the feast was over, "let us all go to the brook and have a drink of its clear, sweet water."
So they flew away, a large and merry band of all sizes and colors, and the child larks joined them, skimming the air as lightly and joyously as any of their new friends. It didn't take them long to reach a sparkling brook that wound its way through the forest, and all the feathered people drank their fill, standing upon the low bank or upon stones that rose above the level of the water. At first, the children were afraid they might fall into the brook, but presently they gained courage, and when they saw the thrush and bullfinch plunge in and bathe themselves in the cool water, Chubbins decided to follow their example, and afterwards, Twinkle also joined them. The birds now bid the child larks goodbye and promised to call upon them, and soon had flown away except the blue jay, who said he would see Twinkle and Chubbins safely home again, so that they would not get lost. They thanked him for this kindness, and when they had once more settled upon the limb beside their nest, the blue jay also bid them good night and darted away for one last look through the forest to see that all was orderly for the night.